Well, Nick, I wanted to talk about your two projects, Old People and People with AIDS. And this is work you did in the late 80s, I think, portraits of people near the very end of life.
Mm-hmm.
What drew you to this theme?
Well, just to set the record straight, I've done two other projects since then having to do with it. I photographed palliative care patients at Dana-Farber and Brigham Women and Hospital about 8 years ago, and just last year I photographed hospice patients.
Oh, wow. Wow. So this is a theme that has continued to draw and inspire you for a long time. How come?
Well, if you Google me or you go to Frankel Gallery, my website, you'll find in the pictures of people, you'll find, or in almost any of my books, you'll find a picture of a man hugging a dog. And he's getting bald, and he's getting old, and the dog is tired and looks like he's getting old and tired too. And the man hugging the dog always struck me as being very touching. It's one of my favorite pictures. So I guess that's a long way of saying I think I was interested in mortality before I even knew it.
Hmm.
I think something drew me to life being sweet and sad and short kind of early on, because it's even the Brown sister pictures that everybody thinks are so much. I mean, they haven't gotten there yet, but that's where they're headed.
These are the pictures you do every year of your wife and her sisters?
Yeah. They state their ambition right up close to be, keep going to the end.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you begin to watch them age. Well, let's talk about the portraits of old people.
Okay.
These began, I think, when you were working as a volunteer in a nursing home?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how it started. It was in my town, and I just was in a frame of mind, which I've stayed in, which is that the right thing to do is to sort of give something back. And so I started to be a volunteer there a couple times a week. And I swore to myself that I would never take advantage of it, to take pictures. Because I can be, if I see you in a room and I see your sweetheart give you a kiss on the ear and it looks terrific to me, I'll ask you if I can take it. You know, I'm not shy. So I wanted something to be off limits. And so I did work there for a year, but then I just broke my word to myself because I was so moved by the people and saw that it wouldn't do any harm, and they knew me and I knew them, and I gave them pictures and I believed in their dignity and stuff, and there didn't seem like there was any downside to it at all.
Your intention was to honor them. The photos do tend to make viewers uneasy, at least at first glance. I mean, I've noticed when I show them to people, the first reaction is kind of both fascination and maybe tinged with a bit of terror.
Sure.
I'm thinking of like the photo of it's beautiful, the very old, very emaciated old man with a shock of white hair.
It's a woman.
Right.
She's 105.
105. People kind of shriek a little bit when they first see her, and at the same time, it is a completely unforgettable face.
Mm-hmm.
What is that discomfort, do you think?
Oh, I think nobody wants to think about death. I think our world is completely isolates itself from thinking about death until it has to. I mean, the word hospice used to be a sort of scary word like cancer 10 years ago, but it's changing now, I think. But the primal urge to push death away. My wife is a social worker at Dana-Farber, and she every day encounters cases where the medical staff want to keep doing everything to keep the patient going, and oftentimes the family, wants to say, well, enough is enough. Let's bring mom home and let her be comfortable. And that's a discussion that happens all the time. And the physicians seem to be not even wanting to consider death as a possibility, and they unfortunately give that idea to a lot of their patients. So, I mean, look at the way we isolate people in nursing homes. We sort of make them being cute and gray-haired and sort of cartoonize them before they, I see it as just, the phase of life that we all go through. And
it's funny, you remind me of taking my children when they were very young, at 2 and 4 maybe, to see their great-grandmother, who was about 100 at the time. And my kids were shy to begin with, and they had never seen anybody that old.
Yeah.
And she reached out to them. She was in a wheelchair. She reached out to them, and they both pulled away and kind of tried to hide behind my legs. And she had such a great sense of humor about it. She reached out with her kind of emaciated hand and kind of cackled at them, you know, like, like a witch. And everybody broke up. And, you know, but I admired her ability to, the fact that she recognized that, yeah, she was scary or had become scary to people. But that's such a complicated emotional place to be.
Oh, it is. But I think if they had grown up in a village or something where they saw it more often and they saw their friends' grandparents grow old and die, then it wouldn't be scary. It would be just, you know, kind of normal.
Yeah. So is there something a little didactic or moralistic about the intent behind your photos? Are you wanting to make us look?
Yeah, I think so. I don't want to be too preachy about it, but I do, as a photography teacher, I call it shadow detail. If you take especially a black and white picture and in the deepest shadows there's no detail, there's no information, then to me that's kind of a shabby thing. I think pictures should have detail in the highlights and the shadows, and in fact it's the shadows that make the highlights have meaning. Because if you only look at the good part, then you're just around with blinders. And if you look clearly and honestly at everything, then the good things have more meaning and the bad things are part of everything. I don't want to be preachy, but yes, I think life's better if you accept that you're going to die and you accept that things will be hard and you are happier then when they're good.
One of the characteristics of your work that critics both admire and also I think struggle a bit to describe is a certain unflinching quality. You know, there aren't a lot of emotional overtones in your work. It's kind of as though, as a photographer, you're not judging anything you see or ascribing any particular affect to it. You're just showing us what is. I mean, first of all, would you agree with that description?
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a lot of feeling myself, but I don't want that to be in the picture unless it's, well, and you will get to some of the pictures of the people with AIDS. That one guy in the beginning, I was very fond of him. I didn't care if it showed then because I liked him so much.
But the others, you wanted to keep your feeling out of them?
I wanted to use my feelings as a way to make the picture about more than just the individual. You like that picture of the old woman because there's something timeless about it, and in some ways she stands for all old women. I don't get that very often, but I hope for that. And the only way I can get to that is by paying really a lot of attention to the individual in front of me and by using my tools and my medium as forcefully and as elegantly as I can. I just want the person to make up their own mind. I hate it when a picture takes you by the elbow and tells you what to think, or tells you how to feel.
What do you do technically to make that happen?
Well, the film is 8 by 10 inches. Do you know what that is? It's a big wooden view camera on a tripod.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it uses film that's 8 by 10 inches. It's very cumbersome. It's very slow. The image on the ground glass is upside down. The pictures are, you know, expensive. I don't take a whole lot. But there are two virtues to it. The main virtue is clarity. There's nothing clearer. If you see an original print, you can count every hair on her head. In a way that's not even possible with digital. It's just the utmost, ultimate kind of description in photography. But B, the style of it suits me because it's kind of collaborative in that I have it sitting next to me, and most people, once they get trusting, sort of feel like it's collaborative, like we're going to do it together. And so there's something kind of slow and
almost old-fashioned, pre-digital.
Very old-fashioned, pre-digital, absolutely. And people, they know I'm not trying to trick them. I don't take anything that they don't want to give.
What did they think? Did they see any of the photos after you?
Sure, I gave everybody who wanted them pictures. Some of the people said, "Are you kidding? Throw them away," you know, or "Give them to my son. I don't want them." But some people had them, and most people, it ranged. The process of making a big camera, large format picture of somebody is kind of unforgiving. In Playboy magazine, for example, they use a great big camera like mine, but then they put a gauzy filter over it to make it seem not so harsh.
maybe we wouldn't find those pictures so erotic if we saw the real thing.
Yeah, maybe not. But the process is pretty unforgiving. So a lot of people who look at themselves in the mirror without glasses stop seeing the wrinkles and stop seeing the moles and stop seeing the aging and the sagging. And so when they see a picture of themselves, especially with reading glasses on, they're often shocked because they see what's there in a way that they haven't been able to or haven't wanted to up to then. It's the hardest with aging women and with maybe all old people, but especially aging women who do all kinds of things to deny their aging and fight it. And so any picture that shows, I mean, my wife's sisters give me trouble because I won't, you know, they joke that I, that to keep on doing it, I'm going to insist, they're going to insist that I retouch.
Well, as an aging woman myself, I have a certain sympathy for them.
Yeah, I would be there myself if I was one. Although I've got to say, because I'm a photographer, I know that the picture is not the truth. And so if I see a picture of myself where I look stupid or, you know, somehow not my ideal self, I don't care. I just laugh. You know, I realize that it's just, in some ways, I'm just putty. Mm-hmm. Putty for some story that somebody's telling.
So let's talk a bit about the photographs from the People with AIDS project. These are photographs you took over a certain time span, right?
Mm-hmm. About 5 years, I think it was.
Yeah. Tell us about how these came about.
Well, AIDS was everywhere.
Yeah.
I had one particular friend who was diagnosed with it. One night at dinner, my wife and I had a couple friend. He was Swedish and tall and handsome and blonde, and his wife was short and Italian and curvy, and they were kind of like opposites together. And he had testicular cancer. Mm-hmm. And so one night, kind of out of the blue at dinner, I said, Rolf, what would you and Denise say if I took a picture of you every month as long as you lived? And he right away liked the idea because he was looking for some way to give form to his illness. So he kind of jumped on it. And she said, oh, let's think about this. Let's talk tomorrow. So when I called him, he said, I'm all for it, but she's not. Because every time you come, for her, it will mean that I'm closer to death and she doesn't want to have to think about it any more than she wants to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I saw completely.
Mm-hmm.
So within like 2 minutes of that, I called the AIDS Action Committee. It had been bubbling around in my mind as something to do, and somehow the idea of following them as they marched through something difficult was something that sort of a little bit came to the surface with them, and so right away it seemed a fit. Well, there are a couple of other reasons I wanted to do it. One, at the time, all the people with AIDS that I saw, at least, were kind of people toward the end, and they were kind of emaciated, and they were mostly gay men, and they mostly looked the same. It's as though the illness took their personalities away and shrunk them. And that, it seemed to me, made it easier for people who weren't gay or in any kind of trouble to sort of hold their arm out straight and say, well, that's not me. I don't do that, and I don't do drugs, so I don't have to worry. That's not me. So I had the audacity to hope that a book of individuals might make at least a few people see that, you know, because once you know an individual, your stereotype always goes away. Once you know the first gay person you know you ever meet and you think they're wonderful, all of a sudden there goes that stereotype.
Right. Ironically, those photographs were controversial at the time. There were some ACT UP activists in particular who thought you were actually doing people with AIDS a disservice.
Yeah, I know that. And I can see their point of view. I mean, as I understood their point of view, it was that everybody who deals with AIDS should be helping, not showing anything unpleasant. And so the cliche was you should only show people living with AIDS.
Yeah, rather than they thought you were creating sort of a photographic equation of AIDS equals death.
Well, at that time it did, and yeah. I thought they were saying you should only do living AIDS was just sentimental bullshit. I didn't say that to them, but there was also, at least in Boston, some resentment because I wasn't gay and because I was well-known coming in and doing my thing. Mm. But I wanted to see, you know, just like I told you before about the old people being a single person in a frame was an interesting problem artistically. In the same way with people with AIDS, I wanted to see how my sort of big camera, slow, elegant frame process, how it could deal with a contemporary epidemic. Could an artistic thing like mine have something to offer? That was kind of the artistic side, the experiment of it.
What did you think you had to offer?
Individuality, showing individuals, showing their spirit, showing their families, showing it in an unprejudiced way that had no agenda except a certain amount of compassion and clarity.
And the other thing that's so remarkable about those is the way you, well, there's a kind of raw physicality to them. I mean, you know, we really see every last physical ravage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which in some ways I would think that would erase some individuality, you know, that we would be so focused on just the body that we wouldn't see the spirit inside. But that's not the case with these.
Oh, partly because everybody's body and everybody's spirit's different. I agree. If you saw the chests of 10, 25-year-old gay men a month before they died, pretty much all the chests would look very similar and just be a question of their hair and their skin color, how much hair there was and stuff. There's a sense of what the illness at the end kind of did in terms of nutrition and shrinking that lent a kind of sameness that was scary. It had its arm on your shoulder.
Yeah, you can practically see the disease as a presence in the room.
Yeah, I think in the beginning that's what made me feel like their individuality wasn't showing. But at the same time, I didn't want to deny that they did look the way I showed them. And also, in 1987, I heard faint rumors and stuff of people living a long time, but there was nobody in Boston who lived more than 5 years after a diagnosis. None of my friends or none of the people I knew in the AIDS Action Committee or none of my subjects knew that at all. There was just AZT, and that was pretty much it. So those pictures, I think, were really of their time.
Yeah.
Early in the 90s, everything kind of opened up with cocktails and multiple ways of treating it that I think all of a sudden there was hope. You know, I dealt with people basically who I thought were going to live a shorter time than I did, and so did they.
The portraits are, they're so intimate, partly because the subjects themselves, the patients, are so completely trusting. I mean, clearly they don't feel they need to hide anything at all from you. It's not just baring their torsos. It's, you know, the openness of their gaze. How did that come about? I mean, did you spend hours with them?
No, everybody was different. It's kind of like, can you imagine let's say you did a project with 10 people for a few years. In the end, you'd like some a lot, and you'd respect everybody because you were working together, but you'd like some more than others. So that's the way I was. There were two or three people in there that I was just crazy about. I had them over to my house, and we did stuff together and had New Year's Eve together, and I kept seeing his mother for years after he was dead, the first one, Tom Moran,
I was going to ask.
He also was the first one to die because his system couldn't tolerate ACT, so he went downhill the fastest, and he knew it. There's a real long, sad story about him I can tell you if you want, but...
I was going to ask you, there's a conversational exchange your wife wrote about when these were first published between you and Tom Moran, and there's just this bit, and I've only seen it out of context, where he asks you for a drink of water, and this was really late, and he wasn't supposed to have any. I don't even remember why. And you said you were worried it might hurt or even kill him, and he said he knew, and he wanted to die, and he trusted you, at least, to be honest with him, and you gave him the water. It's such a moving moment, but that's out of context. What was going on?
Well, we would have been friends if it wasn't for the age difference and the education difference. Not so much age. He was an Irish Catholic townie who nobody in his family had finished college. Most of the men in his family had been alcoholics. Nobody had been gay before. His father had died of cirrhosis of the liver in, ironically, Shattuck Hospital in Boston, which was the hospital that, at the time of Tom's illness, was the best place in Boston for AIDS treatment. They had a whole floor of volunteers and doctors and nurses just dealing with AIDS patients. And so, I mean, and it was bright and people were singing and stuff. And it was as nice a place as you could imagine going if you were ill. So Tom knew he was living in his mother's house which was humiliating because he felt like a failure, and he also couldn't tell her he was gay. I mean, she probably knew, but it was just one of those things. There was mm-hmm. a lot of repression there.
Yeah.
So Tom knew that he would probably end up at Shattuck when things got too hard, and so it was a bittersweet kind of thing knowing that his father went there too and that Tom himself had been an alcoholic. So if you follow the pictures in the book, there's one where he's kind of dressed up and looking in the mirror, and he's kind of smiling and bright, and his hair's combed, and he's all spiffy. And then the next picture after that, that was New Year's Eve. And then the next picture after that is, you know, about a week later, early in January, and he's sitting slumped over on the couch, very emaciated. Only 7 or 8 days have passed, and he's sitting on the couch, and that's the day that he's going to have to get taken to hospital. He's had a downturn. And so he calls me up and says, they're going to take me today. You better come over. And so I'm standing there with the camera, and I'm crying. And I'm just, you know, kind of broken up because he looks so sad. And I know he won't be with us for very long. And so, but he had this wit, this wonderful, wonderful, sharp wit. He said, goddamn liberal, typical of you. Take the picture, for heaven's sake. What good is it going to be if you get tears on the film? Take the picture. He was funny, and we got mm-hmm. each other, and I really liked him, and I really liked his mother, and I could easily see myself in his place if I'd have been born in a family like that. He knew me so well. I'm kind of driven, you know, I like to work every day, and I love to take pictures, and rarely a day goes by that I don't either be in the darkroom or take pictures. And so Tom knew me so well that he'd call me up and say, hey, Nick, have you got anybody today? And if I didn't have anybody, he'd say, come on down. You know?
And so come on down. I'm looking a little worse. You can take another picture.
Yeah, come on down. We can go to the beach, and I'll look sad for you. You know. And he and his mother got pictures all along, and I think they liked them. Mm-hmm. They really liked the attention, too, because, you know, it was sort of a big deal for somebody to come all the time and take pictures of them. And part of my style is to only take what I like, and mm-hmm. irony and criticism aren't, really, I don't think they're wrong. It's just not how I work best.
So, Nick, I'm just curious. It's been, you know, we're talking about photos you took in the 80s, but as you said at the beginning, you've continued to take photos of patients in palliative care, in hospice. I'm not sure there is another photographer living who has spent so many years gazing so unflinchingly on the physical evidence of our mortality. What effect do you think it's had on you?
Some of my doctor friends have mentioned they at least theoretically worry about that. I have to say, if this goes in print, it'll probably come back to haunt me. But I have to say, because it's what I want to do artistically, it's really what I want to do. And so that drive to just create something meaningful kind of abates any sense of being directly depressed by somebody's situation. I guess you could call it a kind of cruelty. But there's a part of me, I mean, my wife has it too. She's the social worker, and she has 6 or 7 cases a day, and some of them are just really awful life and death situations. And she has learned to keep it in control, to not get depressed. And she had a case in the beginning when she was just started where she was seeing the children of a woman whose husband had beaten her to death in front of them.
Oh.
And they flew her to the hospital from New Hampshire, and she died in the aircraft. And so the kids only had their grandparents. Fortunately, they had fairly young grandparents to take care of them. But dealing with those grandchildren and those children kind of undid her. She, you know, had to sort of retract and think about it and talk to somebody and figure out a way to not be completely become ineffective
mm-hmm.
because of her grief.
She had to put up some barriers.
Yeah, she did. And I really admire what she does. I feel like a dilettante sometimes compared to her.
Well, it sounds like you've had to do something of the same. But I guess I being an optimist, I guess I would suggest maybe a different interpretation, which is that and your wife, too. You're both making something out of suffering. I mean, you're giving something back.
I hope making some meaning out of it we'll make some sense of it, and we'll balance off the good that we have. It seems. Do you know have you ever heard of Galway Kinnell, the poet?
Of course.
He just died, and I heard an interview with him that they played a few days ago, and he said something very similar. They said, "Why do you deal with such hard things?" And he said the same thing. He said, almost literally, to give the brightness meaning, to give the brightness depth.
That's lovely. Nick, thank you so much for talking today. This was just terrific.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was just great. Thank you.
My pleasure.